From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, journalist Naomi Klein discusses her new book, No Is Not Enough, Resisting the New Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. Patient advocate Leslie Michelson reveals how we can negotiate better health care for ourselves and our loved ones. And Emmy winner Regina King joins us for a career conversation. But first, from the ongoing fight with the media, the deepening Russia scandal, and the messy fight over health care, it doesn't look like the Trump White House's political troubles will end anytime soon. Yet his closest aides and members of the Republican Party continue to support his message, publicly at least. Our next guest is George Lakoff. He's an author and professor emeritus of cognitive science and linguistics at UC Berkeley. He joins us now to unpack the power and the science of President Trump's messaging. I got inundated with questions that people wanted me to ask you when I had you back on this program. So I'm glad to have you back.
My pleasure. It's really great to be here.
My great delight to see you, sir. I had tons and tons of questions all over social media for Professor Lakoff. This one comes from Shelley Singh Henry. The attempts by our new administration to condition citizens to discredit the media and distract from their underlying agenda are becoming more obvious. Would love to hear Professor Lakoff as he explains the scientific factors at work used to assist the Trump administration's plans. Why is he being so effective? And by effective, I just mean that it's conversation 24/7 whenever he says anything about the news media. What's behind that, and why is it so effective?
Well, first, it works because first, all ideas are in your neural circuitry. They're in your brain. They don't float in the air. Mm-hmm. Once you hear them, anytime you hear them, if you understand them, it activates some neural circuit to understand them. Anytime it's repeated, it activates that circuit again. And the more it's repeated, the stronger it gets. And as the circuits are more activated, at some point, they become semi-permanent or then permanent. So if he starts attacking the media as saying fake news, fake news, fake news, then people who believe what he says, as people who have strict father morality and have his view of how the world should be, mm-hmm. are not going to they're not going to hear that on the media. They're not going to hear his version on the media, and so they're going to say, oh, the problem is that the media is against him and against us.
And all he has to do to make that believable, to make that an issue for the people who support him, is merely just to keep saying it?
He has to keep saying it, and saying it in such a way that it goes against, it goes in favor of the people who believe him and what their moral view is. When Trump got elected, these people said, ah, finally, America is the way it should be. Mm-hmm. It's the way we understand it. And of course, a lot of liberals said, whoa, now we're oppressed. You know, now we have to resist and we have mm-hmm. to persist and say other things and change all this. Mm. This is part of the way things work in people's brains. When you have two opposite views of the world, they're there physically in your brain. And when they're about morality, about what's right and what's wrong, they define who you are as a person. And you don't want to vote against who you are as a person. You don't want to argue against who you are as a person. And, you know, and if the country doesn't fit who you are as a person, if what you see on TV doesn't fit it, if it fits the opposite view, you feel that that's got to be wrong because I can't be wrong. Mm-hmm. I can't be a wrong person. I know what's right and wrong. So they got to be wrong.
Mm. I read a piece in the New York Times. It raised a lot of questions for me. I think that the two professors, the two researchers who wrote the article missed some critical pieces in their analysis. So I wasn't in total agreement with the piece, but I read the piece and I was fascinated by it because the piece spoke to the research that they had done on Hillary Clinton's tweets and Donald Trump's tweets 6 months out from Election Day. They spent a lot of time, these two researchers, analyzing both of their tweets. And one of the takeaways from the article was that Trump has done a masterful job, my word, not theirs, but a masterful job of putting out what they called morally charged tweets.
Absolutely.
Morally charged tweets. That he did that much better, they argue, than Hillary Clinton did.
Oh, yeah.
These morally charged tweets. And as a result, Trump had a 15% higher retweet rate.
Yes.
Than Hillary did. So he's better at morally charged tweets. They resonate with this audience around these issues of morality. They get retweeted a great deal more than Hillary's tweets. And then he went on not just to analyze hers, but to look at Republicans and Democrats and the Senate and how they tweet. But it was a fascinating piece. I'm raising that with you now since you mentioned the word morality. What is it about these morally charged tweets that Trump is so good at that gets under people's skin, that makes half of us upset and the other half love him and retweet what he says?
Because all of our politics is based on morality. If anybody gets up and says, here's my policy, do what I say, the assumption is it's right, not wrong. Mm-hmm. They don't say it's evil, do it. You know, the assumption is it's right. And, you know, and you have two opposite views of what's right. What I've called a nurturant model, one where you assume that government cares. As Lincoln said, it's of, by, and for the people. For the people means government cares. Mm-hmm. You have another version of that in progressive thought, where citizens care about other citizens, work through the government to provide public resources so that everybody has their well-being served, their protection, and freedom served. Mm-hmm. And this is true both of businesses and ordinary people. Now, that is crucial to progressive thought. And the problem is that nobody ever says it. Though that is crucial, it's part of the unconscious way of what's behind thought. 98% of thought is unconscious. Mm-hmm. It's carried out by your neural system. Thoughts don't float in the air. They're in your neural system. And you don't have conscious access to it. So what's conscious is tiny compared to what's unconscious, and these moral systems are part of your unconscious, but they determine everything you think is right and wrong. Mm-hmm. And you have two opposite views of right and wrong here. So this is crucial. That's why morality matters. Now, Hillary went out and says, she didn't talk about morality. I tried to convince her to do so once, but didn't work. Mm-hmm. She didn't do it. She talked about competence. You know, I have experience, I know better, I am strong, I know how to work with the other side, all of that stuff. No morality, mm-hmm. nothing. Everything Trump said was about morality, about right and wrong. And it was his version of mm-hmm. right and wrong. And in his tweets have a structure. People think that he's crazy and he does crazy things at night. The opposite is true. He has four types of tweets. One of them is what I call preemptive framing. He tries to frame the issue his way first mm-hmm. in one of the tweets. So he tries to get the people to believe it his way. The second is diversion. The Russian thing is getting close to him, so he attacks somebody in the media, Micah or somebody, mm-hmm. and he creates a diversion, and then for the several days, they don't talk about Russia, they talk about something else.
Right.
So diversion. Then there's attack the messenger. Somebody says something about him being awful or wrong, and he comes back 10 times as strong and attacks the person who said it. And that can be the media. If the media reports honestly on something that doesn't fit what he says or suggests that he's doing something illegal mm-hmm. or immoral, then he comes back and attacks the messenger. Mm-hmm. The fourth is trial balloons. You know, say, everybody should have nuclear weapons. Let's see if that one works. Right, those are the four things. And combinations of those. Every tweet is one of those four things.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I really don't want to believe that he's any brighter than the people who run news organizations in this country. They're educated at the same schools, they've got experience in the same way he does in their own lane. I do not believe that Donald Trump is smarter, wiser than the people who run the news business in this country. So my question is this, based on that assumption, why can't they just decide to not cover his tweets? I mean, in other words, why not cover what he does or doesn't do policy-wise, but not cover the Trump sideshow? Why can't they just decide in their own minds, we're just not going to cover those tweets. We're not going to cover that nonsense.
Money. The Nielsen ratings.
I hear that, and I'm not even pushing back. I get the money in the news ratings, but they say, Professor, that they don't like him calling them fake. They don't like the way he attacks the news, but they don't like, but they diss him for saying it, but they disseminate it to all the rest of us.
All right, exactly, and here's why. Whenever you use somebody else's language for moral language, you are helping them.
Right.
Because every word that is defined relative to someone else's moral language activates that circuit in somebody's brain, in the public's brains, and every time it's activated, it gets stronger. In order to negate something, you have to activate what you're negating. So, like when Nixon said, "I am not a crook," everyone thought of him as a crook.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a book called "Don't Think of an Elephant." You know, you think of an elephant.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So there are all these people in the news media who have a false belief about reason. A lot of people who are educated in journalism school, I often lecture at the Berkeley Journalism mm-hmm. School, or in political science courses and so on, they learn that reason is, as Descartes said in 1650. Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." He assumed all thought is conscious, 98% unconscious. He said, he was a mathematician. He says, "When I think, it's like going through a proof in mathematics, that thought is logic."
Mm-hmm.
He said that that notion of rationality is what makes us rational animals, human beings. So everybody has the same rationality. Now, that is what's taught implicitly in journalism school and in and also that language is literal. It just fits the world mm-hmm. as it is. Can't be metaphorical and so on, when it is metaphorical. So what happens is people learn that view of what thought is, and then they can't get out of it. So they think that if they diss somebody, which is negating what they said, they're actually helping the other person, but they don't know it because they think thought is logic. And in logic, negations negate something and wipe it out.
Mm-hmm. That's why I wanted you back. That is why I asked you back. I apologize. I had all these questions in my head that I wanted to get to, but the professor, as always, was so brilliant. Forgive me for not getting to more of your questions, but I did just want to acknowledge that so many of you reached out to us after his last appearance on this show. So that just means you got to come back again. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. My next guest, Naomi Klein, is an award-winning journalist and author of several best-selling texts, including No Logo and The Shock Doctrine, in which she reveals how America's free market policies have come to dominate the world. Her latest book is called No Is Not Enough: Resisting the New Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. In the book, she argues that the election of President Trump was a logical extension of trends of the past half century. She joins us now to tell us more. Naomi, good to have you back on this program.
Great to be with you, Davis.
Good to see you. You regard Trump's election in November not as a peaceful transition of power, but as a corporate takeover. Unpack that for me.
Well, look, he ran this campaign promising to be the savior of the white working class, promising to take on Wall Street, said he was so rich he didn't need anybody's money. He attacked his rivals in the Republican Party and Hillary Clinton for being in the pocket of Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. He was going to drain the swamp, take the lobbyists out. And what has he done? Five Goldman Sachs executives in his cabinet, which is incredible. He's not the first president mm-hmm. to spin that revolving door, but never to this degree. And appointed the CEO of Exxon to be his Secretary of State, which, you know, there's so many sort of shocking events in the mm-hmm. Trump presidency. We can forget just how shocking that is. The largest private oil company, a company that was under investigation by three states' attorneys general in the United States for knowing about climate change, doing its research into climate change, and then deceiving the public, deceiving their shareholders, and on and on. There are many examples of this where it's just almost like they cut out the middleman. You mm-hmm. know, the mask is off, and it's just kind of like that idea: if you want something done right, do it yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's sort of what's happening with Trump's cabinet of millionaires and billionaires, and they're pushing through the wish list, or they're trying to, yeah. on tax policy, health policy, this transfer of wealth, systematic from lower and middle income people to the 1% of the 1%.
It's one thing to define a corporate takeover by the personnel that one chooses. That's different, can be different, mm-hmm. than the policies they advance. Just because it's one yeah. set of personnel doesn't sure. mean they have to advance a certain set of policies. But I hear you starting to make the argument that this personnel group is advancing policies that you would expect in a corporate takeover.
And is once again very different from how Trump campaigned,
right?
Because he did promise to renegotiate trade deals in the interest of workers, mm-hmm. and now it turns out that his idea for renegotiating NAFTA is to make it even better for corporations and worse for workers. He promised to protect people's health care, their Social Security. He's attacking it, and frankly, I don't think we've seen the worst, because you know, if they get their tax cut through, then they're going to create a budget crisis, right? They're going to run out of money, and then that will become the pretext for even going after Social Security even more, I think, an even more radical agenda.
I asked this question to some friends in a conversation the other day, somewhat rhetorically, but not really. But I want to ask you seriously now on this program, which is how the media can get away with dissing the president and disseminating the tweets at the same time. I don't know how you do both of those. You can't. Now, my point is, mm-hmm. you can't act like you're mad at this guy for calling you fake news 24/7. You know, and you're acting like you're really upset with this guy mm-hmm, mm-hmm. for dissing you, mm-hmm. but you keep disseminating the tweets. How do you diss and disseminate at the mm-hmm. same time? And the second thing is the media really that upset with Trump? I mean, they act like they're really upset with this guy for dissing them and calling them names, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera, and going after Joe and Mika and going after mm-hmm. CNN. We're all so upset yeah. with the president going after the media. Are they really that upset if they keep covering him and if their ratings stay up? How mad are they really?
I think this is a really reciprocal relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think that... Look, I mean, this idea that they are standing up for the truth in the face of this president who's attacking the press, well, then show us, mm-hmm. you know? Let's really dig into some truth here and see some really powerful investigative reporting. Mm-hmm. And this is why it matters. And I think, honestly, we are seeing the fallout from treating news as a commercial business. Because if it is a commercial business, mm-hmm. and it is, mm-hmm. you know,
it is.
Then they're just... They're following their business imperative. Mm-hmm. They're following the ratings because we're all complicit in this, right? Everybody who turns it on and who feeds this addiction, who clicks on on that clickbait instead mm-hmm. of maybe a little bit of a less sexy story like the implications of Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all part of this, and we need to send feedback through our viewing and reading mm-hmm. habits that show that we actually do care about this. But I do think that the greater responsibility lies with the media. But the real issue in terms of, you know, whether the media is pro-Trump or anti-Trump, the real issue is that one of the major issues is that the leadership in the Democratic Party is fueling this. Like, if they wanted to turn the focus to the economic betrayal, say, and some of the polling really shows that when you put to Trump voters mm-hmm. these basic facts about how many Goldman Sachs executives he's appointed, they really don't like it, right? Well, why aren't the Democrats making more hay out of this? Well, maybe that has something to do with their own proximity to mm-hmm. Wall Street and an unwillingness to really seize back some of the economic populist ground, mm-hmm. right? And build a genuinely multiracial coalition around a promise of redistributing some of the wealth that is so stuck at the mm-hmm. top and using it to pay for universal health care and upping the minimum wage and these things that will really be resonant.
How would the Democrats get that message out? How could they do that truthfully when they were behind a candidate who was giving speeches to Goldman Sachs, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Et cetera, making a bunch of money? So I hear your point, and I think you're right about that, but how do you, with a straight face, advance that agenda now when the person you were behind was taking the same money?
Well, I think that this is about what the next step is,
right.
You know, and getting ready. And this is why, you know, I called it no is not enough, because mm-hmm. it isn't enough to just expose Trump as a fraud, as a hypocrite, whatever it is. That's part of it. Mm-hmm. But the other part of it is making an offer that says this is the real thing. You know, mm-hmm. this is how we address the urgent needs that Trump was tapping into for jobs.
But that's
right?
The Bernie Sanders yeah. agenda, which they rejected. Yeah. They didn't want Bernie as their nominee.
They did. They did reject it last time.
Yeah, so that's my question. So how now? That's, you see what I'm getting
but
at,
luckily,
right?
Luckily, it's not only up to them. With the, you know, there are voters who get to intervene at a certain point. I just came back from a week in the UK, right. Spent some time with Jeremy Corbyn and people mm-hmm. around him. They've just come out of this election cycle where they didn't win the election, but they won a historic number of seats, and they did much, much better than was expected. The whole idea of calling this snap election in the UK was mm-hmm. to wipe out Jeremy Corbyn. What turned it around for him was putting forward a manifesto, as they call it in the UK, mm-hmm. that put workers front and center, major investments in the universal public mm-hmm. healthcare system that has been starved, better wages, taking climate change seriously, welcoming refugees, ending wars, really a transformative agenda that spoke to people's better selves. And it turned out that you can lead with ideas, but you do need a trusted messenger.
When in your subtitle you used the phrase, winning the world we need, winning the world we need. A few questions unfairly, but I'll put them out and give you the space you need to answer them. One, these days, what do we mean by winning? I'm not sure the definition of winning for the U.S. now, mm-hmm. particularly for the U.S., is the same definition that I would have given 20, 40 years ago. So what is winning, number one? And when you say the world we need, can we agree on the world that we need? And finally, what do you say to those persons, those Trump supporters, who feel like they're not a part of that we to begin with?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, it's funny, we had big debates about the we mm-hmm. in the title.
I can't imagine that.
Because yeah. Just saying we is political.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Who is the we?
Yeah.
Who is the we? But I went for it anyway. Mm-hmm. I risked a we. And I guess part of it is just coming from the climate justice movement mm-hmm. and feeling pretty confident that the economic and social model that we have right now is at war with life on Earth mm-hmm. and that there has to be a we. And I can't control if everybody, you know, if there, certainly there's going to be Trump supporters who are mm-hmm. never going to feel included mm-hmm. in that we. But I mean, the truth is, I did write the book for, you know, I wrote the book for the movement. It is a movement. Mm-hmm. It is a movement book. And I think we live at a time when people who identify with being part of the resistance is growing. Mm-hmm. You know, so if there's one thing we can thank Trump for, it's that he's been a kind of a wake-up call, where a great many more people understand that he is a symptom of a system failure, not the failure itself, mm-hmm. right? If Wall Street can cheer on news of his election, if you know Fortune 500 companies can line up behind this man, if he can be praised in the corporate press for launching missiles over chocolate cake at Mar-a-Lago, that there is something deeply sick at work, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the we I'm speaking mm-hmm. to. It's the people who understand something is deeply, deeply wrong. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to build a broader we, you mm-hmm. know, trying to do a little bit of the work, and no one person can do it. And I am, you know, I'm so lucky to have you know, so many people who help me with the book and who are doing this same work from different angles and trying to weave the we, you know, mm-hmm. weave a broader mm-hmm. we. But bringing it to climate, we have to be able to say that if we have an economic system that is bringing us every day closer to ecological mm-hmm. collapse, we need a different world. And we can't be afraid to say we in mm-hmm. that sure, context. Sure. But we, at the same time, can't play, well, my crisis is bigger than your crisis. You know, climate, we'll fix climate first and then we'll fight poverty and racism. No, we mm-hmm. have to find a way to solve multiple problems at once. We need punctuated transformation, change on multiple fronts. We need to radically bring down our emissions in a way that builds a much, much fairer economy and begins to heal wounds that date back to our country's founding. Yeah. And it is possible to do that. It is possible for the communities that have been on the front lines of the most abusive practices, including ecological practices, to be first in line to own and control their own renewable mm-hmm. energy projects. And these are some of the solutions that I highlight in the book that I don't claim any kind of ownership over, that come from the movements themselves.
Well, I'm with her. Naomi, that is. The book is called No Is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World That We Need. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Leslie Michelson is an expert in medical case management and an advocate for patient education and empowerment. His book, The Patient's Playbook, How to Save Your Life and the Lives of Those You Love, has been described as a primer on making the right moves as an active participant in your health care. Leslie, good to have you on the program.
Thank you, Tavis. It's my privilege.
By being an active participant, you mean what exactly?
Well, you know, Americans are great consumers throughout the entire economy. The one place where they don't express their consumerism is when it comes to their health care. And what I've learned is that everybody can get better health care just by learning how to become a better healthcare consumer.
Are we afraid? Are we intimidated? What's the reason why in that one arena we tend to shy away?
It's both of those things. Yeah. And when it comes to your health, people get nervous. They get intimidated. They get scared. Mm-hmm. So that consumer DNA that people are so good at using when it comes to buying cars, planning vacations, picking a school for your kids, gets suppressed. So I wrote the Patient's Playbook to teach everybody how to harness the consumer DNA that they have to get the very best medical care.
What is it specifically about healthcare that causes us to be frozen by our fears?
Well, you know, when you're forced to confront your own mortality, when you sit in that doctor's office in a flimsy gown, and the doctor says some of those very dangerous words, you have cancer, we need to do surgery, you get paralyzed. And you want to believe that everything that doctor's doing is exactly right, but doctors will perform better when people overcome those fears, when they follow the teachings and the guidance and use the tools and the techniques in the Patient's Playbook, and they learn how to partner with their doctors.
Let me run through in the time I have on this program these six steps that might help us get more out of our experience with our physicians. Number one, diagnosis is specific and confirmed.
So these are my six steps to getting to the no mistake zone, which is the process I've developed over the decades, applicable across all of medicine to get people better outcomes. And it starts with a diagnosis. 10% of all deaths in the United States of America are the result of diagnostic errors. So the very, very first thing everybody needs to do is make sure that their diagnosis is specific and independently confirmed. Make sure that it truly is breast cancer before they start treating you. Make sure that it is a herniated disc in your back or whatever it is. Because if there's ambiguity in the diagnosis, virtually every single subsequent step is going to be random or wrong.
10% out of the aggregate isn't a high number, but it's 10% too high. Why is it still sitting at 10%?
Because the healthcare system doesn't check all the time, and patients don't insure and make certain that they get second opinions on things like diagnoses. Yeah. Look, doctors are terrific. They're some of the most hardest working, most caring people I've ever met. But like you, like me, they all make mistakes. Yeah. And it's up to the consumer, the individual patient, who frankly pays the consequence if it's wrong, to get a second opinion, to have that x-ray seen by another orthopedist, to have those slides from the tumor tissue read again to make sure that they're exactly right.
Step number two, convinced about when and why.
So determining when to treat a medical condition is really important. There are medical emergencies where hours and minutes matter, and you need to be persuaded that that's the case for you. But in so many other circumstances, you have the time to do some homework, to think about options, to see if there are other experts who might have different perspectives on it that might be better for you. And you need to ask your doctors, do I need to get this thing treated right now? Or do I have a couple of days or a couple of weeks, which you generally do, to make sure that you're getting it done right?
Mm. Number three, explore and understand the most promising treatment options.
So we live in the golden age of biomedical research. Never in the history of the world have there been so many developments that are so positive, happening so quickly. And patients can find that information online. The problem is it's a bit tricky. And what I encourage everyone to do is either to read the Patient's Playbook, to go on our website, thenomistakezone.com. There's all sorts of guidance about fabulous websites. And the good news, Tavis, is they're all free. So, for example, there's a great website called expertscape.com. Mm-hmm. You just put in your diagnosis. It might be breast cancer, colon cancer, fibromyalgia, whatever it might be. Click enter, and it'll immediately give you the physicians who have done the most research on that particular diagnosis. Mm. And if you happen to live in California, New York, or Illinois, or wherever you are, you can then focus on that state and find the doctors in your community who have the greatest expertise, and it's free of charge. For every single diagnosis, there are multiple philanthropies focused on that, whether it's breast cancer, lung cancer, prostate cancer, where there are people waiting by their telephones right now who have the expertise to help you. All you need to do is go to their websites, reach out to them. They'll provide you great information.
Number four, met with experienced physicians at appropriate hospitals.
So community hospitals are terrific institutions for most things, but if you have a serious problem, if you have esophageal cancer, if you have an aortic dissection, if you need a very serious intervention, it makes sense to go to a major academic medical center in your city, in your community, and identify the physicians with the greatest expertise in exactly what you have. Look, experience matters and practice makes perfect. So when people focus on doing something a lot, do it in the context of a research environment, they typically get better outcomes. And the best news about that is it doesn't cost anymore. Most of the physicians who are at the major academic medical centers are inpatient in most of the insurance plans. So you as an individual don't need to pay more to get somebody who's at the top of the game.
Step number five is you can see your treatment plan with clarity.
Everyone has great intuitions. We've all made good decisions, and we made some crummy ones over the years.
I know I have, yeah.
Yeah, me too. But think about those decisions you've made that have been the very best. When you've collected information, you've stayed in neutral till all the data is in place, and then something magical happens. Your intuition engages, and you can see the decision, and you wake up and you say, that's the right decision for me. And what I encourage everybody to do is to do that when it comes to their healthcare. And I've done this for thousands of people over the decades. And when people follow the six steps of the no mistake zone that I lay out in the patient's playbook, they get to that day, they call me up and say, I've seen three doctors, I've made sure the diagnosis is right, I've gone online, and you know what? It's Dr. Smith in Good Samaritan Hospital that I want to do the surgery, and I'm crystal clear on it, and you know what? That's always the right decision. And when I tell people to do it, it's the last step in getting to the no mistake zone, is if you follow that process and your intuition kicks in, proceed with courage and confidence because you're now in the no mistake zone and you've done everything that you can.
And that is step number six. Your gut is telling you that this is the right treatment and the right physician for me.
Right. And listen to your gut, which we all do in so many other realms of life. But that intuition, which I think is incredibly valuable to people, tends to get suppressed when it comes to healthcare.
How does the medical industry, how do physicians and other professionals respond when patients start to express their own rights, they start to express their own interests? Because I can tell you a number of industries that come to mind pretty immediately, when you start pressing back, they don't take so kindly to that.
And one of the reasons I wrote the patient's playbook is to teach patients how to partner with their physicians. So at the 95, 98% level, they're going to get the proper engagement from their docs. Look, doctors don't have the time they need. They don't have the resources they need. Nurses are challenged to take care of everybody that they need to take care of. And my view is we have this incredible reservoir of intelligence and energy called the 320 million Americans who become patients at some point in their lives. And if those people can follow the teachings and the practices of the patient's playbook, they can make it easier for physicians and nurses to be at the top of their game. And most every time, and it doesn't happen all the time, but most every time when you follow the teachings, the physicians embrace it and recognize that you're going to be a partner in your care.
What's in this book for people who go to their doctor's offices and what they are subjected to, maybe even unwittingly, is a lack of culturally competent care? So I walk into an office and they just don't get me, they don't get my culture. How do you press those issues?
You should never be with a physician that you don't feel is respecting you for who you are, that doesn't accept the values that motivate you, and doesn't respect and honor your culture. You should never be there. That person is too important in your life. And what I encourage everybody to do, if you have that sense, and one way or another we've all been there, which you say, you know, this person was not treating me the way I deserve to be treated, you should get a better physician. And one of the things we talk about in the patient's playbook is how to find a primary care physician, where it's so important to have a strong and enduring relationship with one, and somebody who gets who you are, where you feel harmonious. So if the day comes when you're feeling crummy, when you have anxiety, when you've had a no good, terrible day, you've hurt your leg playing basketball, or you've eaten something and it's not sitting well with you and you're really scared, you've got somebody that you can trust, who trusts you, who respects you, and you're gonna follow. That's a really important relationship. And what I teach people to do is to follow the process we lay out in the book to find that person.
I used a cheat sheet to give you some sense of what is in this beautiful book. with a lot of great advice in it. You want to get it for yourself. It's called The Patient's Playbook, How to Save Your Life and the Lives of Those You Love by Leslie D. Michelson. Chock full of very good information. Good to have you on the program, sir, and thanks for the text.
Tavis, thank you so much.
My great pleasure. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Regina King is a two-time Emmy winner. She made her television debut on the hit sitcom 227. She's appeared in so many films and TV projects since, including Jerry Maguire, Ray, and most recently John Ridley's American Crime, which garnered her two Emmy Awards and a Golden Globe nomination. Before we start our conversation with Regina, I'll look back at some of her brilliant work.
I don't know what you do for your 4%, but this man, my husband, has a whole plan, an image. And when you put him in a waterbed warehouse commercial, excuse me, you're making him common. When you know we deserve the big four. Shoe, car, clothing line, soft drink. I know about the four jewels of the celebrity endorsement dollar.
Wow.
I want you to leave her and come and be with our baby.
You got your damn mind. You knew the rules when you got into this. Good damn well I ain't gonna leave my family.
Leave your family. You are a damn fool, you know that. Between the dope and the music and me, you are ready to leave your damn family. You see the way Jason smiles at you? No one else will ever love you like that. Ever. I want to know what that feels like, Reggie. I want to be able to hold that kind of love in my arms. I want to look in my child's eyes, and I want to see someone I care for.
So I'm laughing because it is so impressive to just look at that, because there are so many child actors who just don't make it.
Yeah.
And even those who do make it, don't make it in a way that you've made.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a serious body of work here.
I have been blessed, yes, to be able to do what I love. And, you know, when you sit there and watch it like that, you know, you're always living in the moment. Mm-hmm. So you don't think about all of the places that you've been before this moment right now. And it's very cool.
Yeah. You're very modest. It's more than cool.
Yeah. It is.
How do you reach, I mean, I guess this is what an actor's job, I guess, is, but how do you reach those emotional places that you're so good at that?
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think part of it is just, it's my art, you know, and I guess when a painter paints or a writer writes or a musician plays, whatever space they go into to express their creativity, it would be the equivalent to that. Yeah. You know, I've been training all my life, so there are, I guess, certain buttons inside that I push to you know, make certain things happen. But for the most part, I'm in the moment of the character that I'm playing. You know, I'm really channeling or trying to embody whatever that woman is in that piece.
Yeah. I don't know if this is a fair question. Let me ask anyway. When you were a kid getting started, is this what you wanted? Did you expect this? Or were you just having a good time?
Right.
And it's not kinda really processing it?
Yeah, it kind of started out as having a good time.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to be a dentist.
Yeah.
And then
nothing
I guess,
wrong with that, yeah.
Yeah, the realization of having to be in people's mouths, I think, kind of let that be a fleeting thing. But I loved my dentist growing up, so I think that's why, because he was such a great dentist.
Right.
And I always heard other kids talk about how much they hated their dentist, but I loved Dr. Rubel. And so I think that's what made me want to be a dentist. But it was a hobby. I used to go to acting classes and so enjoyed it. My sister and I did it together, and we'd, you know, do plays and things like that. And then 227 came, and then it just kept going. And then I went to college and decided that I didn't want to stay in college. I wanted to really approach it as a career opposed to a hobby.
Yeah. You were blessed. That's my word, and you'll choose your own word to my mind.
I like that word.
You like that?
Yeah.
That word?
Okay. Yeah.
So it seems to me that you were blessed, Regina, when you were on 227, in that you were around some veterans and some veteran black women.
Absolutely.
I mean, you could have started doing something else and not have been in that sort of incubator.
Mm-hmm.
That had to be.
It was, I mean, it's such
Gibbs
a big
and,
part of why I'm here. And I remind people all the time about Marla being one of the first, like with a trailblazer. Like, people forget Marla was the executive producer of 227 and the star of 227. And she had her own Marla's Memory Lane and acting. It wasn't an acting school. It was an acting, like, shrine, you know, because Marla, I got to get a front row seat to see how a woman who's a boss operates, and I didn't realize I was getting all of that as I was, you know, absorbing it, but I was, because I'm making, you know, similar moves now.
Yeah.
So Marla, gosh, that's my other mommy.
Yeah. Speaking of your similar moves, so you're not just acting, you're producing, you're writing, you're directing. Like, this is like...
Yeah, it's all been like a natural progression or expansion, I like to say, because I'm never leaving the one in the dust. It's kind of to do it all together. But I think one of the things that I love about acting is that, you know, we observe things, and that's what actors do. We take it in. Mm-hmm. You know, we're students of life, you know, just that you do this all the time.
Yeah.
If ever I was playing Tavis, I would remember to do this or this, you know. But I think because I'm taking it all in all the time, I'm able to employ these gifts that come along the way.
Yeah. How has the, to the extent that it has, how has the directing aided your acting?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
In a huge way.
Yeah.
I think because at one aids the other.
Mm-hmm.
As a actor that went out and directed a film and then came back as an actor, I immediately respected the director even more.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I didn't respect the director before, but I was more willing to just the director tell me where you need me. We don't even need to talk about it. I'm gonna try it your way. And I guess it opened me up more in a lot of ways. And then as a director, just it helps my communication with other actors.
Yeah. This might not be the words you choose, Regina, but it seems to me that if American Crime did nothing else for you, it stretched you.
Yeah.
Those three seasons, I hate to see it go. And John was here not too long ago. But tell me about the experience of doing American Crime over those three seasons.
Oh, gosh, it is really hard to put that in words because, you know, as actors, we dream to be a part of a situation like that. Situation, for lack of a better word, to come to my mind quickly, I would say, because situation minimizes it, because it was such a beautiful...
Like utopia.
Yeah, really. You know, as actors, the perfect world is to have a repertory, like, feeling and get paid like you get paid on TV or movies, but not Broadway money. So we had that feeling. So at the end of one season, it was just the excitement to find out, well, what story are we going to tell this season?
Yeah.
Well, what are we coming back to do? And John was so great at filling us in on a little bit, and we would have like a long conversation. John is not short on words.
Mm-hmm.
So
we know this.
Yes. So we would converse about the roles that he was thinking about for us to play for the next seasons. And, you know, we'd speak for hours, and he would take that, and they would go to the writer's room and then come back with these gems.
Yeah. What's your end game, to the extent that there is one? What are you hoping to do with all the stuff that you are doing?
You know what? I think I don't think there is an end game.
Yeah.
You know, I just, you know, I got the
battery in my back.
Yeah,
you
know? I love that.
Keep going. You know, when people ask, would you expect to be here? Yeah. Did you think that this was going to be what your life is? I can't say that I thought that it was, but I can't say that I thought that it wasn't. I just feel like I've listened to the universe. I kind of just let the universe guide me. So there is no end game. Who's to say, you know, where, when I come back and sit in this chair, or where, what I'll be talking about, you know, or what I'll be doing.
Yeah. It's been fascinating to watch, and this is clearly a legitimate issue, and you've talked about this, and you've been very courageous to speak about it publicly, which is the lack of opportunity for people of color in this industry. And yet, while that is the reality, it's been empowering to watch you just keep moving anyway.
Yeah, you know, I've had so many people that have been so supportive of whatever I want to do. You know, when I was making the move to direct, just all of the men that embrace me in our industry, from Paris Barkley to John Wells to Christopher Chulock to John Singleton, and I can just name so many that, you know, didn't allow me to doubt myself. You know, they saw some things that I didn't even know existed.
I don't want to sound paternalistic, but I am so proud of you.
Thank you. I received that. Hey, anybody says that they don't appreciate when someone genuinely expresses that, pays that forward, they're lying.
But just to watch the way you have grown, it's just such a beautiful thing.
Yeah, thank you.
You're doing it.
Still
you.
Growing.
Yes,
still growing.
We all are. Good to see you, Regina.
Good to see you.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing, or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsiabwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.